from Elmhurst Public Library. This is Storytime for Grown-Ups. I am Margie Kohlbacher. Welcome to Episode 5. Stories have the power to inspire and change us. Being read to stimulates our brains and expands our imaginations and is just plain fun. Today's first piece is titled Father of the Groom, written by Pulitzer Prize-winning author and columnist Dave Barry. This essay comes from his book titled I'll Mature When I'm Dead. Our second story is called Wasp's Nest, written by Agatha Christie, one of the best-selling authors of all time. This short story comes from her collection of tales involving her famous Belgian detective, Hercule Poirot. Sit back, listen, and enjoy.
Father of the Groom by Dave Barry. On my son's wedding day, when I saw him standing up there in front of everybody, waiting for his bride, I had this sudden, intense awareness of the passage of time. To me, it seemed as if only a few days had passed since Rob was playing happily in my living room, flying his remote control helicopter. Then I realized that, in fact, only a few days had passed. I got him the remote control helicopter as his wedding gift. Well, he may be a grown man, but he's still a guy. Anyway, it was an amazing feeling watching my son get married. The whole weekend was very emotional for me. I cried like a baby. And that was just when I saw the bill for the rehearsal dinner. But seriously, before I say anything that might be construed as criticism of the vast and constantly expanding wedding industrial complex, which currently accounts for 38% of the U.S. economy, let me state for the record that I loved my son's wedding. He found a wonderful bride in Laura, a smart, beautiful, warm, talented, and funny woman who is absolutely perfect for him. They had the best wedding in human history. And I'm not saying this solely because I had many glasses of champagne and danced with approximately 27 women simultaneously to play that funky music, white boy. So, I have no complaints about the wedding. I must say, however, that the planning of the wedding was a tad stressful. In the same sense that the universe is a tad spacious. And for good reason. Planning a modern wedding is comparable in scope to constructing a nuclear power plant, although the wedding is more complex because, to pick just one of many examples, a nuclear power plant does not require floral installations. These used to be called flowers, but that was before the florist, the floral installation artist realized that floral installations is more professional, as measured by how much you can charge for installing them. Which brings us to budgeting. Here's my advice for parents who are going to be planning a wedding. At the very beginning, decide exactly how much money is the absolute maximum you are willing to spend. Write this number down on a piece of paper and keep it with you at all times. That way, when the wedding is over, you can pull it out, look at the number, and laugh until a streamer of drool reaches all the way down to your feet, which will be bare in as much as you can no longer afford shoes. Here's the problem. The bridal magazines, which depend for their existence on advertisements for the wedding industrial complex, have for decades been hammering home the three core principles of the modern American wedding. First principle, your wedding is the most important day of your life, so you want it to be perfect. Second principle, however, it does not have to cost a lot of money. Third principle, however, if it doesn't, it will suck. These principles resonate powerfully with your modern bride-to-be because ever since she was a little girl, she has been fantasizing about her wedding day. This is not true of your modern groom-to-be. When he was a little boy, he was, I state this with authority, conducting experiments to see what happens when you set fire to He-Man action figures. But the bride has been dreaming for years about having a fairy tale wedding, patterned after the wedding scene in the Walt Disney animated film Cinderella, wherein Cinderella and Prince Charming ride off into the sunset in a horse-drawn carriage while the cute little mice wave goodbye. What they don't show you in this film is parents in bare feet paying the bills for the carriage rental, the horse supplier, the mouse wrangler, the sunset installation professional, etc. Because all of these things cost money. And if you hold the wedding in New York City, as we did, all of these things will cost extra money because you will be paying for unionized mouse wranglers. True story. My wife inquired at the hotel where we held the rehearsal dinner about the cost of renting a projector and screen so that we could show pictures of Rob and Laura as guests arrive. The hotel said that, counting the fee for the two workers required by union contract to set the equipment up, it would cost us, I'm not making this up, $1,800. Which, of course, is more than it would cost, outside of Planet Manhattan, to buy a projector and screen, as well as a used car to drive them home in. My point is that putting on a modern wedding is an expensive and complicated undertaking, which is why many people these days hire a professional wedding planner, whose function is to make it even more expensive and complicated. The planner works closely with the bride, as well as the only other really essential person in the wedding, by which, of course, I mean the bride's mother. At this point, the groom is pretty much out of the picture. If the wedding were a solar system, the bride would be the sun, her mom would be another, slightly smaller, nearby sun, the wedding would be a third sun, the caterer, floral installation professional, photographer, videographer, cake design engineer, etc., would be planets orbiting these suns. And the groom would be an asteroid the size of a regulation softball, 73 trillion light years away. Sometimes the groom gets so far out of the wedding planning loop that the planners forget to invite him to the actual wedding, and the bride, at the last minute, has to marry a member of the catering staff. This happened to Madonna twice. Fortunately, Rob made it to his wedding, and as I say, it was a grand day. Rob looked handsome and nervous. Laura looked radiant. They both looked beyond happy. For me, the highlight of the service was the exchange of vows, which was performed by six union vow exchangers. No, seriously. Rob and Laura wrote and spoke their own vows. Hers were funny and smart and sweet. And Rob's, I say this with a father's pride, were amazing. When he told her, with pure and simple eloquence, how much he loved her, his voice broke. And every woman watching went, "Oh!" And Laura's eyes shone like moonlight on a mountain lake. And if you could watch that, your son, the boy you used to carry on your shoulders and tuck in at night, now a grown man, putting his heart out there in front of everybody, for the woman he adores. If you could watch that and not spill tears all over your tuxedo dress shirt, then you'd be missing out on the one thing that made all the wedding hassle worthwhile. I'm talking about the champagne. No, I'm talking about the love between Rob and Laura. It radiated from them and filled the room, infusing all of us with joy. It was a feeling that lingered even after the reception ended, and we rode back to the hotel in a taxi driven by a man who spent the whole trip carrying out a loud cell phone conversation in what I believe was Martian. I even felt a certain affection toward him. Okay, that was the champagne. Wasp Nest by Agatha Christie. Out of the house came John Harrison and stood a moment on the terrace looking out over the garden. He was a big man with a lean, cadaverous face. His aspect was usually somewhat grim, but when as now the rugged features softened into a smile, there was something very attractive about him. John Harrison loved his garden, and it had never looked better than it did on this August evening, summery and languorous. The rambler roses were still beautiful. Sweet peas scented the air. A well-known creaking sound made Harrison turn his head sharply. Who was coming in through the garden gate? In another minute, an expression of utter astonishment came over his face, for the dandified figure coming up the path was the last he expected to see in this part of the world. "By all that's wonderful," cried Harrison, "Monsieur Poirot!" It was, indeed, the famous Hercule Poirot, whose renown as a detective had spread over the whole world. "Yes," he said, "it is I. You said to me once, if you are ever in this part of the world, come and see me. I take you at your word. I arrive."
"And I'm delighted," said Harrison heartily. "Sit down and have a drink."
With a hospitable hand, he indicated a table on the veranda bearing assorted bottles.
"I thank you," said Poirot, sinking down into a basket chair. "You have, I suppose, no syrup?"
No, I thought not."
"A little plain soda water, then? No whiskey."
And he added, in a feeling voice, as the other placed the glass beside him,
"Alas, my moustaches are limp. It is this heat."
"And what brings you into this quiet spot?" asked Harrison as he dropped into another chair.
"Pleasure?" "No, mon ami, business."
"Business? In this out-of-the-way place?" Poirot nodded gravely.
"But yes, my friend, all crimes are not committed in crowds, you know."
The other laughed.
"I suppose that was rather an idiotic remark of mine, but what particular crime are you investigating down here? Or is that a thing I mustn't ask?"
"You may ask," said the detective.
"Indeed, I would prefer that you asked."
Harrison looked at him curiously. He sensed something a little unusual in the other's manner.
"You are investigating a crime, you say?"
He advanced rather hesitatingly.
"A serious crime?"
"A crime of the most serious there is."
"You mean
murder?"
So gravely did Hercule Poirot say that word that Harrison was quite taken aback. The detective was looking straight at him, and again there was something so unusual in his glance that Harrison hardly knew how to proceed. At last he said,
"But I have heard of no murder."
"No," said Poirot.
"You would not have heard of it."
"Who has been murdered?"
"As yet," said Hercule Poirot, "nobody." "What?" "That is why I said you would not have heard of it. I am investigating a crime that has not yet taken place."
"But look here, that is nonsense."
"Not at all. If one can investigate a murder before it has happened, surely that is very much better than afterward. One might even, a little idea, prevent it."
Harrison stared at him.
"You are not serious, Monsieur Poirot."
"Oh, but yes, I am serious."
"You really believe that a murder is going to be committed? Oh, it's absurd."
Hercule Poirot finished the first part of the sentence without taking any notice of the exclamation.
"Unless we can manage to prevent it." "Yes, mon ami, that is what I mean."
"We?"
"I said we. I shall need your cooperation."
"Is that why you came down here?"
Again Poirot looked at him, and again an indefinable something made Harrison uneasy.
"I came here, Monsieur Harrison, because I, well, like you."
And then he added in an entirely different voice,
"I see, Monsieur Harrison, that you have a wasp nest there. You should destroy it."
The change of subject made Harrison frown in a puzzled way. He followed Poirot's glance and said in a rather bewildered voice,
As a matter of fact, I'm going to. Or rather, young Langton is. You remember Claude Langton? He was at the same dinner where I met you. He's coming over this evening to take the nest. Rather fancies himself at the job.
Ah, said Poirot.
And how is he going to do it?
Petro and the garden syringe. He's bringing his own syringe over. It's a more convenient size than mine.
There is another way, is there not?
Asked Poirot.
With cyanide or potassium.
Harrison looked a little surprised.
Yes, but that's rather dangerous stuff. Always a bit of a risk having it about the place.
He waited a minute and then repeated in a grave voice. Deadly poison.
Useful if you want to do away with your mother-in-law, eh? Said Harrison with a laugh.
But Hercule Poirot remained grave.
Are you quite sure, Monsieur Harrison, that it is with Petro that Monsieur Langton is going to destroy your wasp's nest?
Quite sure. Why?
I wondered. I was at the chemist in Barkchester this afternoon. Forewarned for my purchases, I had to sign the poison book. I saw the last entry. It was for cyanide of potassium, and it was signed for by Claude Langton.
Harrison stared.
That's odd, he said. Langton told me the other day that he'd never dream of using the stuff. In fact, he said it oughtn't to be sold for the purpose.
Poirot looked out over the roses. His voice was very quiet as he asked the question.
Do you like Langton?
The other started.
The question somehow seemed to find him quite unprepared.
Of course I like him. Why shouldn't I?
I only wondered, said Poirot placidly, whether you did. And as the other did not answer, he went on, I also wondered if he liked you.
What are you getting at, Monsieur Poirot? There's something in your mind I can't fathom.
I am going to be very frank.
You are engaged to be married, Monsieur Harrison.
I know, Miss Molly Dean, she is a very charming, a very beautiful girl. Before she was engaged to you, she was engaged to Claude Langton. She threw him over for you.
Harrison nodded.
I do not ask what her reasons were. She may have been justified. But I tell you this. It is not too much to suppose that Langton has not forgotten or forgiven.
You're wrong, Monsieur Poirot. I swear you're wrong. Langston's been a sportsman. He's taken things like a man. He's been amazingly decent to me, gone out of his way to be friendly.
And that does not strike you as unusual?
You use the word amazingly, but you do not seem to be amazed. What do you mean, Monsieur Poirot?
I mean, said Poirot, and his voice had a new note in it, that a man may conceal his hate till the proper time comes.
Hate? Harrison shook his head and laughed.
The English are very stupid, said Poirot. They think that they can deceive anyone, but that no one can deceive them. The sportsman, the good fellow, never will they believe evil of him.
And because they are brave but stupid, sometimes they die when they need not die. You are warning me, said Harrison in a low voice. I see it now. What has puzzled me all along? You are warning me against Claude Langton. You came here today to warn me.
Poirot nodded.
Harrison sprang up suddenly. But you are mad, Monsieur Poirot. This is England. Things don't happen like that here. Disappointed suitors don't go about stabbing people in the back and poisoning them. And you're wrong about Langton. That chap wouldn't hurt a fly.
The lives of flies are not my concern, said Poirot placidly. And although you say Monsieur Langton would not take the life of one, yet you forget that he is even now preparing to take the lives of several thousand wasps.
Harrison did not at once reply. The little detective, in his turn, sprang to his feet. He advanced to his friend and laid a hand on his shoulder. So agitated was he that he almost shook the big man, and as he did so, he hissed into his ear.
Rouse yourself, my friend. Rouse yourself, and look. Look where I am pointing. There on the bank, close by that tree root. See you? The wasp returning home, placid at the end of the day. In a little hour, there will be destruction, and they know it not. There is no one to tell them. They have not, it seems, a Hercule Poirot. I tell you, Monsieur Harrison, I am down here on business. Murder is my business. And it is my business before it has happened, as well as afterward. At what time does Monsieur Langton come to take this wasp nest?
Langton would never.
At what time?
At 9 o'clock. But I tell you, you're all wrong. Langton would never. These English,
cried Poirot in a passion. He caught up his hat and stick and moved down the path, pausing to speak over his shoulder.
I do not stay to argue with you. I should only enrage myself. But you understand, I returned at 9 o'clock.
Harrison opened his mouth to speak, but Poirot did not give him the chance.
I know what you would say. Langton would never, etc. Ah, Langton would never. But all the same, I return at 9 o'clock. But yes, it will amuse me. Put it like that. It will amuse me to see the taking of a wasp nest. Another of your English sports.
He waited for no reply, but passed rapidly down the path and out through the door that creaked. Once outside on the road, his pace slackened. His vivacity died down. His face became grave and troubled. Once he drew his watch from his pocket and consulted it. The hands pointed to 8:10.
Over 3/4 hour, he murmured. I wonder if I should have waited.
His footsteps slackened. He almost seemed on the point of returning. Some vague foreboding seemed to assail him. He shook it off resolutely, however, and continued to walk in the direction of the village. But his face was still troubled, and once or twice he shook his head like a man only partly satisfied. It was still 9 when he once more approached the garden door. It was a dear, still evening. Hardly a breeze stirred the leaves. There was, perhaps, something a little sinister in the stillness, like the lull before a storm. Poirot's footsteps quickened ever so slightly. He was suddenly alarmed and uncertain. He feared he knew not what. And at that moment, the garden door opened, and Claude Langton stepped quickly out into the road. He started when he saw Poirot.
Oh, good evening.
Good evening, Monsieur Langton. You are early.
Langton stared at him.
I don't know what you mean. You haven't taken the wasp's nest?
As a matter of fact, I didn't.
Oh, said Poirot softly. So you did not take the wasp's nest. What did you do then? Oh, just sat and yawned a bit with old Harrison. I really must hurry along now, Monsieur Poirot. I'd no idea you were remaining in this part of the world. I had business here, you see.
Oh, well, you'll find Harrison on the terrace. Sorry I can't stop.
He hurried away. Poirot looked after him, a nervous young fellow, good-looking with a weak mouth.
So, I shall find Harrison on the terrace, murmured Poirot. I wonder.
He went in through the garden door and up the path. Harrison was sitting in a chair by the table. He sat motionless and did not even turn his head as Poirot came up to him.
Ah, mon ami, said Poirot, you are all right, eh?
There was a long pause, and then Harrison said in a queer, dazed voice,
What did you say?
I said, are you all right?
All right? Yes, I'm all right. Why not?
You feel no ill effects? That is good.
Ill effects? From what?
Washing soda.
Harrison roused himself suddenly.
Washing soda? What do you mean?
Poirot made an apologetic gesture.
I infinitely regret the necessity, but I put some in your pocket.
You put some in my pocket? What on earth for?
Harrison stared at him. Poirot spoke quietly and impersonally, like a lecturer coming down to the level of a small child.
You see, one of the advantages or disadvantages of being a detective is that it brings you into contact with the criminal classes. And the criminal classes, they can teach you some very interesting and curious things. There was a pickpocket once. I interested myself in him because, for once, he has not done what they say he has done. And so I get him off. And because he is grateful, he pays me in the only way he can think of, which is to show me the tricks of the trade. And so it happens. I can pick a man's pocket if I choose, without his ever suspecting the fact. I lay one hand on his shoulder, I excite myself, and he feels nothing. But all the same, I have managed to transfer what is in his pocket to my pocket and leave washing soda in its place.
You see, continued Poirot dreamily,
if a man wants to get at some poison quickly to put in a glass unobserved, he positively must keep it in his right-hand coat pocket. There is nowhere else. I knew it would be there.
He dropped his hand into his pocket and brought out a few white, lumpy crystals.
Exceedingly dangerous, he murmured, to carry it like that, loose.
Calmly and without hurrying himself, he took from another pocket a wide-mouthed bottle. He slipped in the crystals, stepped to the table, and filled up the bottle with plain water. Then, carefully corking it, he shook it until all the crystals were dissolved. Harrison watched him as though fascinated. Satisfied with his solution, Poirot stepped across to the nest. He uncorked the bottle, turned his head aside, and poured the solution into the wasp's nest. Then stood back a pace or two, watching. Some wasps that were returning alighted, quivered a little, and then lay still. Other wasps crawled out of the hole only to die. Poirot watched for a minute or two, and then nodded his head and came back to the veranda.
A quick death, he said. A very quick death.
Harrison found his voice.
How much do you know?
Poirot looked straight ahead.
As I told you, I saw Claude Langton's name in the book. What I did not tell you was that almost immediately afterward, I happened to meet him. He told me that he had been buying cyanide of potassium at your request to take a wasp's nest. That struck me as a little odd, my friend, because I remember that at that dinner of which you spoke, you held forth on the superior merits of petrol and denounced the buying of cyanide as dangerous and unnecessary.
Go on.
I knew something else. I had seen Claude Langton and Molly Dean together when they thought no one saw them. I do not know what lover's quarrel it was that originally parted them and drove her into your arms. But I realized that misunderstandings were over and that Miss Dean was drifting back to her love.
Go on.
I knew something more, my friend. I was in Harley Street the other day, and I saw you come out of a certain doctor's house.
I know that doctor, and for what disease one consults him. and I read the expression on your face. I have seen it only once or twice in my lifetime, but it is not easily mistaken. It was the face of a man under sentence of death. I am right, am I not?
Quite right. He gave me 2 months.
You did not see me, my friend, for you had other things to think about. I saw something else on your face. The thing that I told you this afternoon, men try to conceal. I saw hate there, my friend. You did not trouble to conceal it because you thought there were none to observe.
Go on, said Harrison.
There is not much more to say. I came down here, saw Langton's name by accident in the poison book, and as I tell you, met him and came here to you. I laid traps for you. You denied having asked Langton to get cyanide. Or rather, you expressed surprise at his having done so. You were taken aback at first at my appearance, but presently you saw how well it would fit in, and you encouraged my suspicions. I knew from Langton himself that he was coming at 8:30. You told me 9:00, thinking I should come and find everything over. And so I knew everything.
Why did you come? Cried Harrison. If only you hadn't come!
Poirot drew himself up. I told you, he said.
Murder is my business.
Murder? Suicide, you mean?
No!
Poirot's voice rang out sharply and clearly.
I mean murder. Your death was to be quick and easy, but the death you planned for Langton was the worst death any man can die. He bought the poison. He comes to see you, and he is alone with you. You die suddenly, and the cyanide is found in your glass, and Claude Langton hangs. That was your plan.
Again, Harrison moaned. Why did you come? Why did you come?
I have told you. But there is another reason. I liked you. Listen, mon ami. You are a dying man. You have lost the girl you loved. But there is one thing that you are not. You are not a murderer. Tell me now. Are you glad or sorry that I came?
There was a moment's pause, and then Harrison drew himself up. There was a new dignity in his face, the look of a man who has conquered his own baser self. He stretched out his hand across the table.
Thank goodness you came, he cried.
Oh, thank goodness you came.
Thank you for listening today. Be sure to join us for our next episode of Mind Expanding Tales.
Storytime for Grownups is recorded at Elmhurst Public Library's Creative Studio Lab. Our director and editor is Josh Jers, our producer and host is Margie Colewalker, and our stories today were narrated by Duard Mosley. Works read in this podcast may be protected under copyright law. These podcasts are reserved for the education of library patrons only. Elmhurst Public Library receives no commercial gain from these recordings. No unauthorized further dissemination of these works is permitted.